happy here. Jeffrey's group, for people who don't know him, he's one of the most well-known and influential people in the field of quantum vibrations. And I think so. And also has done influential work concerning quantum information. And we're very, very pleased that he's here for the year as a visitor and look forward to more simulation discussion beginning with this talk here.
Thanks, Dave. Well, I'm very happy to be here. And I'm going to talk about quantum computation now. What I still think is probably to talk is to talk very generally about what I was trying to do. I mean, when I say where does the speed up come from, what I was really interested was getting some kind of conceptual handle on what's going on in the quantum computation as opposed to really just seeing exactly how she put this.
As opposed to just seeing how the mathematics produces the computation, but to get some kind of picture of what's going on conceptually. And what I wanted to do was to get away from the idea, because it doesn't seem to me right, that essentially what's going on in a quantum computation is a kind of massive parallel computation in different possible worlds, which is Deutsch's picture. That doesn't seem to me to be the essential feature of a quantum computation. So basically what I did and what I'm going to talk about in this talk is I looked at the sort of the first few algorithms. And beginning with the very simplest one, which is Deutsch's XOR algorithm, which is even more simpler than the algorithm for what's called Deutsch's problem, which is even simpler than the algorithm for the Deutsch-Yosei algorithm. And I think essentially everything is really contained in that very elementary XOR problem. What I want to show is that if you consider Simon's problem, which is a period finding algorithm, then it's essentially the same as the structure, the sort of geometrical structure involved in Deutsch's problem, Deutsch's XOR problem. And Shor's algorithm also turns out to involve the same kind of thing. And so I want to show that, and then in the end consider the question of, well, you know, really what is it about a quantum computation looked at in that way, which is responsible for the speed-up. Okay, so I'm going to talk about, begin with the XOR element. I'm not going to talk about all the variations because they're not essential to what I want to do today. And then I'll talk about Simon's algorithm and Shor's algorithm and then consider the question of the speed-up. So now, all three algorithms involve the determination of a global property of a function, which is a disjunctive property. And a disjunction is represented by a subspace of Hilbert space. And alternative possible disjunctions, which are alternative possible solutions to the computation, will be represented by different orthogonal subspaces. And I'm going to show that it turns out that these different orthogonal subspaces overlap slightly. So they're not technically orthogonal. They're orthogonal except for an overlap. And the point of the algorithm is to determine the true disjunction, that is the subspace containing the state in a measurement. And because of the overlap, algorithms generally have to be run several times. But if the state, when you make a measurement, if you project the state into the overlap region, then it's inconclusive. And that seems to me essentially the feature of these three algorithms, Shor's algorithm and the various Deutsch algorithms and the Simon algorithm. There are other algorithms which may not fall into exactly to this framework. Okay, so, and the essential feature of these quantum computations is that you distinguish the true disjunction from alternative disjunctions without determining the truth values of the disjuncts. And that's possible because the disjunctions are represented, so to speak, quantum logically in terms of the subspaces of the Hilbert space, as opposed to being represented set theoretically as alternative subsets of a set. And so in a classical computation, that would be impossible. You wouldn't be able to determine the truth value of the disjunction without determining the truth value of the disjunct. OK, so let's take a look at the very simplest XOR algorithm. B is Boolean algebra. And that is, we're given a black box or oracle that computes a function. And a function from a Boolean algebra from 0, 1, to 0, 1. And we want to determine whether the function is constant, takes the same value on both inputs, or is balanced, takes different values. And classically, the only way to do that would be to consult the oracle twice and then compare the values. So what goes on in this, I'll go slowly with this because this is the central core of the thing, even though everybody knows it, but I want to just bring out the essential features because the same features that are played over and over again, which is somewhat surprising, I think. It's not surprising here, but in the Simon and the Shore algorithm in particular. So you've got input and output registers, which are initially set in the state 0 and 0. You apply the Hadamard transformation to the input register, which gives you, you know, linear superposition, as I said, over all possible input values. And then you apply a unitary transformation, which corresponds to the black box. And that correlates input values with output values. And this enables you to, enables the transformation to be reversible because you're keeping the input. And so that's what it looks like. I've got a pointer here. So you've got 0 with wherever 0 goes, and 1 with wherever 1 goes. And if the function is constant, then you get 0 going to 0, and 1 going to 0, or 0 going to 1, and 1 going to 1, which means that you end up with this state or this state. And if it's balanced, you end up with 0 going to 0, and 1 going to 1, or 0 going to 1, 1 going to 0. And so you end up with either of these two states. Now, those states are orthogonal, and they span two planes, which we could call a constant plane and a balanced plane. And those two planes are orthogonal except for an overlap or an intersection. And the intersection is, sorry, let me just go back here. And the intersection is this state right here. Which you can write in terms of the constant balance states that way, or go to the prime basis, it's easier to see what's going on there. Then the intersection is the state 0 prime and 0 prime. The prime basis is just the basis that you get by applying a Hadamard transformation to the 0 and 1. And then the intersection is the state 0, 0 prime, and the constant plane is spanned by 0 prime, 0 prime, and 0 prime, 1 prime, and the balanced plane is spanned by 0 prime, 0 prime, 1 prime, 1 prime, so the intersection is the 0, 0, 0 prime.
So, are you defining the intersection?
The intersection of the two planes, sorry.
Oh, just the two planes, right? Okay.
Yeah, these are two planes. Well, what I mean is two orthogonal planes, in Hilbert space, would be two planes, two subspaces which are orthogonal, would have all their vectors be orthogonal in the sense that the scalar product is zero. But that's not the case. I mean, it's more like, well, let me draw a picture of what it looks like. I have a picture here. It's basically looks like that. So in a four-dimensional Hilbert space, you've got the constant plane, which is spanned by this state and that state, and the balanced plane, which is spanned by this state and that state. This is a four-dimensional Hilbert space, of course. So there's another line, 1 prime, 0 prime out here, which gives you another plane, which is orthogonal to the constant plane and the balanced plane. Actually, that plane turns out, which I haven't drawn yet, to be involved in the Simon algorithm. But essentially, what the algorithm does is, when you run the algorithm, the state ends up either in this plane, actually either sort of halfway between here and here, or rotated right angles, or it ends up in here, or rotated right angles, but in the balanced plane. So if you make a measurement, then if the state is in the constant plane, you might collapse it onto the 0, 0 prime, which is inconclusive, because it could equally well be a balanced state. But if you end up in this state or in this state, then you know that the function is either constant or balanced, and that's going to interfere with probability cost. Yeah.
Just for those of us who are not experts, I think you went through it too fast. Oh. What is the XOR problem and
what is what is the XOR problem? The problem was just that you're given a Boolean function that is a function from 0, 1 to 0, 1. And so there are only four possible functions. I mean, there's a constant function, and there's what Shor calls a balanced function, where 0 and 1 are taken to different values. If it's a constant function, if 0 goes to 0 and 1 goes to 1, or, sorry, 0 goes to 0 and 1 goes to 0, that's where the function takes the input, or 0 goes to 1 and 1 goes to 1. It's balanced if 0 and 1 go to different outcomes. And so the problem is, given a black box, which is implementing one of those functions, how can you determine whether the function is constant or balanced? Now, what I said in the beginning was you just, classically, you would just run the algorithm twice, I mean, and you would see whether it's constant or balanced, because you would see where 0 goes to and where 1 goes to. I mean, you'd run it twice with different inputs and just see where 1 goes to and where 0 goes, and then if they're the same, it's constant. If they're different, it's balanced. This quantum algorithm enables you, with probability half, to determine whether the function is constant or balanced in one run. So this was the first real quantum computation algorithm. And of course, it's pretty useless in that half the time you fail to get an answer. And so on average, it's not faster than a classical computation, and because if you did a whole bunch of these things, you'd be no better off. But there is the feature that if you're lucky, you can get the answer in one run. And the whole point of the talk, actually, is just to say that, just to show that Simon's algorithm, which is more complex, Shor's algorithm, which is much more complex, that really they just involve the simple idea. Because what is the simple idea? Well, the simple idea is that the propositions that you're trying to determine, I mean, you want to know, is the function constant or is the function balanced? That is to say, does the function have a certain global property? Constant being a global property about the function, or balance being a global property about the function. And what a computation enables, what quantum mechanics enables you to do, is to represent these propositions by subspaces in an orbit space. Classically, subspaces in a linear space or a projective geometry. Classically, you'd have to represent such disjunctive statements. It's a disjunctive statement because, take the constant statement. That's an OR statement. Either 0 goes to 0 and 1 goes to 0, or 0 goes to 1 and 1 goes to 1. So that's a disjunction. And quantum mechanically, you can represent these disjunctions by subspaces. And it turns out that what a quantum computation, at least what these algorithms, the Simon algorithm and the Shor algorithm and the Deutsch algorithm, exploit, is the fact that these disjunctive statements can be represented by subspaces which, as I put it loosely, are orthogonal except for an overlap. That is, they're like the constant balance plane. They have a vector or sometimes a whole subspace in common. So in the case of the Simon algorithm, it's going to turn out that the planes, or rather, they're not planes, they're subspaces. The subspaces which correspond here to just a constant balance plane are going to be higher dimensional subspaces which intersect in lower dimensional subspaces. And so you have to run the algorithm a number of times because you can end up in the intersection. And with the Shor algorithm, it's the way in which these different subspaces overlap is slightly more complex still. But the basic idea is just to run the algorithm enough times so that even though these propositions or subspaces overlap, you can still, with several repetitions, get an answer to the problem in a way which is much faster than you can do classically. I mean, in the case of Simon's algorithm, the speed up is exponential. In the case of Shor's algorithm, it's exponential over any known classical algorithm. Okay, so let's just continue. Let's see. Well, time is going on, so look, I think I'm going to, sort of obvious here, I'm just going to jump. Let me jump to the Simon algorithm, because I suspect that I can jump in various variations of this thing. Simon's algorithm. Okay, Simon's algorithm. That algorithm is supposed to, the problem is to find the period of a periodic function where b to the n is 0, 1, tensor product of 0, 1 at 0, 1 n times. And it's you're told that this function is a Boolean function for which, well, that's what it means to be periodic, that fxi is fxj, if and only if xj is equal to xi plus the period. And because these are Boolean algebra, and x plus the period plus the period is x, the function is a 2-to-1 function. So here's the way the algorithm usually goes. You start with the input and output registers in the state up there. So the input register is a multiple of all the Boolean algebras, different registers 0. And then you apply Hadamard transformation to the input register, so you get all possible sequences of zeros and ones. And then you apply the function which implements the algorithm, so x gets correlated with fx. And because this is a periodic function, it's going to look like that. It's a 2-to-1 function, and xi and xi plus the period gets mapped on the same value, say xi, fxi. And now, in order to see how the algorithm works, consider what happens if we measure the output register. Actually, no real measurement that has to be taken of the output register, because this is just a sort of a simple way of thinking about what's happening. Really, the input register is in a mixture, if you consider the input register alone. But it's going to be a mixture of these states. So it's sort of it helps to say, well, suppose we measure the output register, then you're going to get the input register in one of these states, which is associated with the mixture. So the input register has that form. And that state contains the information R, the period, but summed with this unwanted randomly chosen offset value, xi, which is going to depend on the outcome of the measurement of the output output register. And so if you directly measure the state label, then you're going to get any value of x equipotently, because this xi could be any value. And you're going to get xi plus, or xi plus the period. So you're going to get any x value. So the idea is apply a Hadamard transformation. And the way it's usually put is the point of the Hadamard transformation in the end. So you start with a Hadamard transformation, which gives you linear superposition. And that gives you all possible input values, as one says. Then you implement the function with the unitary transformation. Then you apply a Hadamard transformation at the end. The function of this is to take this random offset, which you don't want, because if it wasn't there, you could just measure and get R. And the effect of the Hadamard transformation, which is a sort of a discrete Fourier transformation, it's completely, it is actually technically a discrete Fourier transformation, and analogous to the discrete Fourier transformation in Shor's algorithm, What it does is it puts the unwanted offset xi into the phase over here. And and what happens here is because if r dot y is 1, then you have destructive interference. And so if you add this up, I mean those terms disappear. Because if you get a 1 here, then you're gonna this term is gonna cancel. So it's only when r dot y is 0 that the terms add up, and then you get this for the value of the state of the input register. And now you finally measure that in the computational basis, and which are the basis shown here, and obtain the value y such that r dot y is equal to 0, because this is summed over all the values of r dot y such that that's 0, summed over values of y rather. And then you repeat the algorithm sufficiently many times to find enough values yi so that r can be determined by solving those linear equations. That's the way the algorithm is usually put. So you start off with the Hadamard, which gives you all possible input values. You implement the unitary transformation. You notice that if you were to measure the output register, the input register would be left in a certain state. You notice that while it doesn't do you any good to measure that state directly, even if it has the value of the period that you want in it, so you apply another Hadamard transformation, and you get the unwanted offset value in phase, and then if you make a measurement, if you make several measurements, you'll be able to determine the period. That's the way it's usually put. Now let me show you that actually involves exactly the same idea as in the subspace idea that I showed you with Shor's algorithm. So consider this elementary case n equal 2, because this was a periodic function from b to the n to b, and let's take n equal 2 to see what's going on. N equal 1 is true. The possible values of the period now are 0, 1. So you're mapping an input which is 0, 0, 0, 1, 1, 0, 1, 1 into the output. And the period can be either 0, 1, or 1, 0, or 1, 1, or 0, 0. So not a possible period. And the corresponding states of the input and output registers after the unitary transformation then is going to be this. If the period is 0, 1, then 0, 0, and 0, 1 are going to go to the same value, which will just be f 0, 0. And 1, 0, and if you add 0, 1, you get 1, 1, will go to the same value, which is f 1, 0, and similarly for the other periods. So you're going to end up, for these possible periods, with these final states. Now, if you take a look at if you recall the Deutsche construction, the state for R 1, 0 is exactly the same as the, looks like this, let me say. The state for R 1, 0 is associated with the balanced plane. The state for R 1, 1 is associated, sorry, the constant plane, R 1, 1 with the balanced plane. And so the three possible periods are associated with planes which look like that. Once you apply the Hadamard transformation, the 1, 0 plane is going to be spanned by 0 prime, 0 prime, and 0 prime, 1 prime. And the 1, 1 plane, period 1, 1, is going to be spanned by these, which corresponds to the balance plane. And then for 0, 1, that's the third plane, which looks like that, basically. So in the Deutsch algorithm, applying the unitary transformation gives you a vector either in this plane, which we call the constant plane, or this plane, which was the balance plane, this plane, the plane spanned by 0, 0 prime and 1 prime, 0 prime, was not relevant there. But here, for the n equals 2 case of Simon's algorithm, you end up either in this plane, or in this plane over here, or in the plane spanned by these two lines. So what you could do is we could simply measure the input register in the prime basis to find the period. And or we could apply a Hadamard transformation, which in this case just amounts to dropping the primes. Because if you go from the zero vector to zero prime vector, I mean, the Hadamard transformation takes you from zero to the prime basis. Applying it again in the end just takes you, just drops the primes. So you could then measure in the computational basis. And so the three possible periods can be distinguished by measuring the observable with the eigenstates. You get the answer, except when the measurement collapses you onto the state 0, 0 prime, which is going to occur with probability half. So the algorithm will generally have to be repeated until we find an outcome that is not 0, 0. So surprisingly, the Simon algorithm, which looks at first sight very different from the Shor algorithm, turns out to involve the same, exactly the same planes, well, an additional plane, as the Deutsch XOR algorithm. And the solution to the problem can be found by just making a measurement at a certain basis and repeating the measurement sufficiently many times until you get an outcome which is not the overlap outcome. So what happens in the case n equal 3? Because you might think, well, that was just a special case. Now there's seven possible periods, 0, 0, 1, 0, 1, 0, 0, 1, and so on. And in the case of the period 0, 0, 1, if you take a look at what the final state is, gains a 2 to 1 function. If you add 0, 0, 1 to 0, 0, 0, you get that. If you add it to 0, 1, 0, you get that, and so on. So you now have a linear superposition of four states. And if you now measure the output register, the input register is going to be left in one of these states. This state. If you represent it in terms of the prime basis, you can write it that way. Applying a Hadamard transformation, because it's easier to see what's going on in terms of the planes or the hyperplanes in the Hilbert space, in terms of the prime basis, so this is equal to that in terms of the prime basis. So if you simply apply a Hadamard transformation, it amounts to dropping the primes. So the period is R0, 0, 1, the state of the input register ends up in a four-dimensional subspace spanned by those vectors. And if you take a look at the other cases, you get all those other subspaces. That is, all these different periods are associated with these different subspaces. And these subspaces are again orthogonal, except for intersections that are two-dimensional. So the subspaces correspond to quantum disjunctions, and determining the period amounts to determining which disjunction out of the seven disjunctions is true. That is, which subspace contains the state, and again, that's done without determining the truth values of the disjuncts. I mean, you just end up knowing that the state is in a certain subspace, and you don't know whether the propositions corresponding to the vectors which out of which a subspace is expressed as a span, which one of those are true. The design of the algorithm doesn't do that. And you can find the period by measuring the computational basis you start out with. And if you do this thing, run the thing several times, you will have enough information to figure out which subset the state lies in. In the case that n equals 3, if you just look at that list that I gave you, it's pretty clear. I mean, I'm going to label this. But just two values distinct from the 0, 0, 0 will enable you to determine the subspace. And these are just the values yi for which r dot yi equals 0. So the way the algorithm is usually formulated is, well, you do it enough times until you find enough value, solve this equation, and get the value of the period. But what it really amounts to from a geometrical point of view is just doing the experiment, doing the measurement over again until you can distinguish these different subspaces. So the subspaces correspond to quantum disjunctions, and again, we've determined which disjunction is true. Now, so let me talk about Shor's factorization algorithm. That, that exploits the fact that two prime factors of a positive integer can be found by determining the period of a function. So it's a function. And there's some number theory stuff which is involved, which is not really relevant to quantum mechanics. So, and I'm sure that people who've looked at this know that, so I'm not going to labor that. It ends up that once you can find the period of a certain function, then you can factorize. So again, it is a period finding algorithm that's relevant. So let me jump to that. So the problem of factorizing a composite integer n that's a product of two primes reduces to the problem of finding a period of a certain periodic function. Now, you go through a similar kind of construction, but it's much more complicated, and it looks something like this. You start off with, your 0, 0, you apply a Hadamard transformation, then you have a unitary transformation, and now you have a periodic function which sort of looks like that. And if you measure the output register, the input register lives in a state like that. That happens if this R divides. It's a little bit more complicated here. And there's several the analysis sort of runs. You have to split here the case that if R divides S exactly and otherwise makes some kind of correction. I'm just going to consider this elementary case where R divides S exactly. This xi is the value of the offset again, which depends on the outcome of your measurement of the output register, and again, the state label contains the random offset, so to get rid of it, what you do is you apply unitary transformation, a Fourier transformation, which is analogous to the Hadamard transformation in the Simon case, and you end up, this is the discrete Fourier transform, and what happens when you apply that is that to the state that you get in the Simon algorithm, you get end up a state like this, where the random offset is again in the phase. And then you you make a measurement, and you get a certain value over here, and then you do it a sufficient number of times, and you get the offset. So how does this look geometrically? Let me just jump. Take the case n equals 15, and n is the number that you're trying to factorize. And then take a look and see what happens. Well, this function, a to the x mod 15, takes these values, 1, 7, 4, 13, and so you can see that the period is 4 over there. Now, you can derive the factor 15, because basically you're factorizing 15 here, as the greatest common factors of a to the r over 2, which is 48, and a to the r over 2 plus 1, which is, so you get factors of 15. But now, if you apply the unitary transformation, you get a state like this, where you're summing 1, 7, 4, 13, so it looks like this. And you can express the state this way, just adding up all the states which are associated with the output 1 and with 7 and with 4 and with 13 and so on. If you measure the output register, then again we get one of these four states, either this state, or this state. And they are the states with this offset value. So apply this discrete Fourier transform, and the states then can be expressed like this. And they are those states which you get when you apply the discrete Fourier transform to the states of the input register after the measurement of the output register with the offset goes into the phase. But what it looks like here is, in this particular case, you get these four states. And now, so for the period R equals 4, which is the case we're doing here, the state of the input register ends up in the four-dimensional subspace spanned by these vectors, 0, 16, 32, and 48. Well, now what's the relationship with the Simon case? Well, there, in the Simon case, we had to consider all possible periods. You know, 0, 0, 0, 1, 1, 0, 1, 1, and so on. So consider all possible periods here. Of course, you don't know what the periods are. You're trying to find the periods. But I'm using this as an illustration of what's going on when you're doing the algorithm. So far, we've just considered one period. And we've seen, for this very special case, that the state ends up in a certain subspace. Well, you know, if the period were different, where would the state end up? So what are the different possible periods here in this particular case where I've got n, the number that I'm factorizing, 15? The other possible periods, the possible values of this A are 2, 4, 8, 11, 13, and 14, if you work this out. Actually, all this comes from a nice example by Barenko in the book edited by Pescu and Lowe and somebody else. So it's 1998. So these are the other possible values of A, and the periods, when you work them out, turn out to be 4, 2, 4, 2, 4, 2. So in this case, the only other period is 4, is 2, because we already considered the period 4. And this, I just note that every value of A except for A equals 14 gives the correct factors of 14, because this algorithm which Shaw is exploiting, the classical algorithm, can actually fail for certain values. And here's an example where it fails. If it fails, you just pick another number, you pick another value of A and do it over again. So we're now considering, well, what happens if R is equal to 2? Well, now if you measure the output register again, you get one of these two states. And obviously, in two states instead of four states, you apply the discrete Fourier transform, you see that the states are either this state or this state. And now in this case, remember in the Simon case, I'll go back to the X or Deutsch case, you just had two planes which intersected in a line. In the Simon case, you had subspaces which intersected in lower dimensional subspaces. In the example that I considered two examples, either the case where you have three planes intersecting in a line, or four-dimensional subspaces intersecting in two-dimensional planes. And if you go higher, it's going to, the same thing happens. But here, you actually have something a little different. You have the two-dimensional subspace associated with the period R equals 2 expand by these states, and it's actually included in the four-dimensional subspace associated with R equals 4. It overlaps, but in the sense that it's just a part of it. Because this R equals 4 subspace was spanned by 0, 32, and some other two other vectors. So a measurement can distinguish R equals 4 from R equals 2 reliably only if the final state ends up in the part of this subspace which is not associated with R equals 2. I mean, the part orthogonal to the R equals 2 subspace. What happens if it ends up in the subspace R equals 2? Well, remember that this algorithm works as a randomized algorithm. It produces a candidate value for the period R, and hence a candidate factor of n, which can be tested in polynomial time by division into n. So the way the algorithm works is that you don't get an answer. You get a potential answer, which you then check. And if it doesn't divide into n, it doesn't give you a divisor of n, well, then you start all over again, run the algorithm over again. So a measurement of the input register in the computational basis yields an outcome. And the value of k is going to be chosen equiprobably. And the idea is to repeat the algorithm until you get a value of k coming to r or something. So let's not bother about all that. So, I mean, the details of these things is, you know, there's no point talking about that here. But I mean, you need to actually look and see how this thing works out. What I want to get across is just that in every case, what's really going on is that you have the propositions that you're trying to get at associated with subspaces in the Hilbert space, and that these intersect in certain ways. And the idea is just to find the right subspace. So what happens here is you just run the algorithm over again. And essentially, this analysis that is in Shor tells you that in polynomial time, you're eventually going to get a value which is, you're either going to, suppose we choose a value with period 2, that I mean, suppose the right answer is that you're actually in the subspace, which is inside the bigger subspace. And suppose you find that value, remember there were two possible values, 32 and I think 0. The only value of k co-prime to r is k equal 1, and then you get the correct period. But this value of c equals 32 could also be obtained for a different value of a, and the period of r equals 4. And that doesn't yield the correct period, and hence doesn't yield the correct factors of n. So, putting it geometrically, this value, the value k equals 1 for r equals 2 corresponds to the same state as the value k equals 2 for r equals 4. But once you obtain the candidate period, you calculate the factors of n as the greatest common factors of a plus 1 and n according to the algorithm and see if it works. And if you happen to have chosen a value a equals 7, that'll be incorrect. If a is equal to 2, then a equals 7 was the value chosen for the period 4. If a equals 2, then the factors calculated in this way will be correct. So if you understand the algorithm as a randomized algorithm, then you see that what's involved is you just run the algorithm over again with the candidate value until it works. And that's what you actually do in the Shor algorithm. So the fact that you end up here with the subspaces overlapping in this way where some subspaces are actually contained in other subspaces is consistent with the way Shor's algorithm is really understood. Okay, so let's now turn to the question about what's responsible for the exponential speed up. Well, we do have an exponential speed up in the case of Simon's algorithm, and so what, and in the case of Shor's algorithm, speed up over any known algorithm. What really is the responsible for the speed up? Well, Deutsch's view, as I said, is that it's this quantum parallelism, which is the first stage, which involves the Hadamard transformation, which gives all possible inputs. And the idea is that a quantum computation is something like a massively parallel classical computation of all possible worlds. There's a critique in a paper by Steen, which I think is correct. Steen in 98, in that paper, sort of a general paper on quantum computation, comments in this way about the Shor algorithm. Period finding algorithm appears at first sight like a conjuring trick. It's not quite clear how the quantum computer managed to produce the period like a rabbit out of a hat. I would say that the most important features are contained in, the linear superposition. So that's the parallelism. The magic happens when a measurement of the wire register, so there would be this register here, produces the special state, you know, with the offset and the period in the X register. And it's quantum entangled when Finch permits this. The final Fourier transform, which is involved in getting this offset into the phase, enabling you to get the answer by several measurements, can be regarded as an interference between the various superposed states in the X register. Now, that seems to me rather unhelpful, because essentially what Steen is saying here is, look, it's entangled, it's superposition, and it's also entanglement, and it's also interference. So it's like everything quantum which does it. So, you know, if you want to know further ahead. Josa points out that the state space of a classical system is the Cartesian product, and the state space of a quantum system is the tensor product, and for n qubits, the quantum state space is 2 to the n dimensions, so the information required to represent the general state increases exponentially with n. And for a classical composite system of n two-level systems, the number of possible states grows exponentially with n, but the information required to represent the general state is just n times the information required to represent a single state, so the information grows only linearly. And this is given as an explanation. Josa and Linden have shown that a quantum algorithm operating on fewer states can achieve an exponential speed up only if you've got multi-particle entanglement that increases unboundedly with the input size. And Vidal has shown that a classical computer can simulate the evolution of a quantum system with computational resources that grow linearly with n and exponentially in multi-particle entanglement. So those are some results that are relevant. But Steen, in a later paper, 203, I think, sort of reading between the lines, really, is saying something like this, which is also the view that I would have been proposing, that the essential feature in at least the computations discussed above is that you're selecting a global property of a function, that is, a disjunction among alternative possible disjunctions, without computing the truth values of the disjuncts. And that this information, the truth values of the disjuncts, is redundant information in a quantum computation. That is, you can just find the subspace without finding, so to speak, the states which you span over to get the subspace. But it's essential information classically. And now, what about this fast Fourier transform and discrete Fourier transform? Some people say, I don't know a lot, but some people do say in the literature that, well, you know, the speed up is all in the fast Fourier transform. Well, the role there of the Fourier transform is simply to allow a measurement in the computational basis. I mean, it takes you into the computational basis and allows you to get a measurement in the computational basis. Why is it even necessary in counting the speed up? Well, you could say, look, we could just simply measure in a different basis. And in the XOR algorithm of Deutsch, actually, I did just talk about measuring in the prime basis and not making a Hadamard transformation back into the computational basis. Obviously, you'd have to perform a computation to determine the right basis. I mean, certainly, you know, if it's elementary, you could say, well, it's an elementary computation, but in general, it's going to be a rather complicated computation. And so this raises the question of precisely how to assess the speed up relative to a classical algorithm. And so you need a convention. How do you count the relevant computation steps? You could say, look, any unit sequence of unitary transformations is equivalent to a single unitary transformation followed by a measurement in a certain, and a unitary transformation followed by a measurement in a certain basis, it just means performing the measurement in a different basis. So any quantum computation can be reduced to just one step, just measure in a certain basis. But obviously, you have to know what the basis is, so you have to perform a computation to find that basis. which sort of makes it silly. So that makes it clear that you need some convention if you want to know, well, how do we actually count the number of steps involved in the computation? And the accepted convention is just to require that the unitary transformations that you use are constructed from some elementary set of gates. So just certain unitary transformations are allowable. And the measurements have to be performed in the computational basis. You can't just perform them in any old basis. The final discrete Fourier transform just takes you back to the computational basis, so that's why you need that. But when people claim that quantum algorithm is exponentially faster than a classical algorithm, then what they're really saying is that the number of steps counted in this way is a polynomial function of the size of the input, and classically it's an exponential, it increases exponentially with the size of the input. But that's clear enough. But what I think is wanted is something like an intuitive conception about why a quantum computer does the magic that it does. And it seems to me that if you look at these algorithms, then it's pretty clear that what's involved is essentially this idea of finding out which this junction is true out of a set of alternative disjunctions, which you can do without calculating the value of extraneous information quantum mechanically, because of the quantum logic, essentially, because of the way in which subspaces fit together as opposed to the way in which subsets fit together. And it's essentially because of that that you have the possibility of the speed. Okay, thanks.
Just trying to figure out whether you sidestepped the question or implicitly answered the question of whether kind of tangling is exponential speed up.
Is
it implicit in the formalism?
Yeah, it's implicit in the formalism because what you essentially, the subspaces that I'm talking about are subspaces in the in this composite Hilbert space, and it's entanglement which produces this entanglement which links the input values with the output values in some state which you of the whole composite system, which you then and then you ask questions about that. That's about where that state
is. Yeah, obviously, you have product states in the larger space, they aren't entangled. But somehow the not every state that you can do. You can obviously do a completely classical computation, but you can map product states to product states.
That would be classical, yeah.
Right. And then the question was, I mean, so people have proposed, for instance, with the Glover algorithm, that you can perform that classically, like just using superposition. It doesn't really, I don't think it gives you an explanation.
Yeah, I didn't talk about the Glover algorithm because I don't think it fits in this picture. But so at least these algorithms do. So I don't.
And these algorithms require it.
Yeah.
Right. Well, these algorithms require entanglement. If you're claiming that any exponential speed up is also going to require entanglement.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. At least if it's accomplished using this general strategy.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. It was kind of answered just then, but I was just wondering if you have anything more to say about whether or not you can relate your view about what causes speed up to properties that people commonly talk about as making quantum-like entanglement and non-contextuality in terms of sort of necessary and sufficient conditions or just if there are any definite links between the two.
Well, I guess my answer to the question would be something like this. When people say, where does the speed up come from? Then different answers are attempted where people take certain features of quantum mechanics that are regarded as essentially quantum and say, well, you know, it's that. So now, what are the essentially quantum features relative to classical mechanics? Well, you know, inference, entanglement, non-locality, maybe contextuality and non-contextuality or something like that. I don't think it's very illuminating, at least I've never understood what I'm supposed to be, what I've gained by having an answer, well, it's entanglement which is responsible for the speed up, or it's the possibility of linear superpositions which are responsible for the speed up. I don't know how to relate that statement to understanding exactly what's going on in a quantum computation. Now, obviously, when you talk about classical mechanics as involving a Boolean algebra, basically, in the sense that, you talk about systems, and you talk about properties of systems, and you talk about the evolution of properties, so you talk about things which have properties and which change, and your dynamics is going to tell you how that happens. Well, the way in which that's represented classically is that you represent the states, which are essentially lists of properties. If you've got a state, you can list all the properties of the system as points in a space. And then the properties are just subsets to say that say that a system has a certain property that its position somewhere in this room is to say that it has a state in a certain subset of phase space. So you've got the subset structure, which is characteristic of classical mechanics, and a set of subsets of a set is a Boolean algebra. So that characterizes a sort of classical logic, in a sense. Now, but then if you go to quantum mechanics, you have the essential feature of the transition is to go from that set of subsets of a set, which is the Boolean algebra, to the subspaces of a linear space, that is a projective geometry. And there, you have all sorts of features associated with complex systems which have to do with the possibility of superposition, the possibility of entanglement, and so on. But instead of talking about superposition, entanglement, and unlocality, from an abstract point of view, essentially what you've got in a quantum mechanical description is a description which has the features of a projective geometry as opposed to a Boolean algebra. And essentially there you can have things like two properties which can be an angle to each other. Well, there's no sense, you know, because they'd be associated with subspaces which are an angle to each other. And subsets would be always at right angles to each other, or, you know, at zero angles to each other, in a technical sense, then, if you're comparing it to the Hilbert space. So you've got new features there, like the angle between propositions, or the angle between states. And as you know, this is associated with probability, and in fact, the only way probabilities can be introduced in this new structure by Gleason's theorem. And so you have a different story, so to speak, a different picture of what's going on. And that picture involves features of entanglement and superposition and so on in the way in which states can be combined. But I think that if you want to get a handle on the difference between quantum computation and classical computation, I don't think it's useful to look at these features of quantum mechanics associated with entanglement and so on. It rather makes sense just to consider what's going on in the way in which propositions are represented. And the only I think the appropriate answer to the question of where does the speedo come from, I mean, where does the power of quantum computation come from? I think the appropriate answer is, well, it comes from the different ways in which properties or propositions are represented quantum mechanically rather than classically. And one means that is subspace structure as opposed to the subset structure. Now, more specifically, one could ask, well, you know, precisely how does that happen? And then you could say, well, the way it happens is take a look at this algorithm. Here, what you're really trying to do is distinguish these disjunctions. And in this quantum propositional structure, they're represented by certain subspaces which overlap in a certain way. And so if you make a measurement, if you make several measurements, you can find out where you are. And that's what's happening in quantum mechanics. So, I guess that's the answer to the question.
This question of where does quantum computation get its power, I suppose, you know, part of the problem is it's not clear from the question what kind of answer expected. So I'm wondering if I could ask you where you think classical random computation gets its power. Let me try and say a little bit more before you answer. Maybe a computer scientist can help me out here, but as far as I know, the associated complexity class BPP is believed to be equal to P, deterministic class, although not actually proven. But nonetheless, there are some problems where the best-known random algorithm outperforms the best-known deterministic one, but perhaps not exponentially outperforms, but outperforms in some way. So it seems it's a question we can ask. I can imagine getting into similar sorts of discussions as in the quantum case. There might be some guy who says, well, in a random computation, I imagine some kind of lunatic who's a many worlds theorist about classical probabilities. He's saying, well, it does all these different things. Look, all these different sort of paths of the random computation can go down. It's doing these at the same time. And you might bring up the same objections to him that you would bring up against someone who says quantum parallelism is the main thing in quantum computation. And another similar feature would be that if you look at a probability distribution over values that n bits can take, there are exponentially many real numbers in that probability distribution, just as there are exponentially many amplitudes of the quantum case. So let me split my question into two. If you had to answer, where does classical random computation get its power over deterministic, how would you answer that? And then if you had to answer, how does quantum get its power over random, how would you answer that?
That's a very interesting question. I honestly haven't thought about that. And I probably should have, but I don't know what to say. I don't have an intuitive understanding of where classical random computation gets its power. But I think that's an important question, which I should have the answer to if I'm going to say something about quantum computation, because that's a sort of the interesting thing about that is that it's a sort of intermediate case, which is probabilistic, but not probabilistic in the way quantum computation is. But it does have more power. So it's something. I guess I'm saying that I can't answer your question, but I should be. I feel like I'm embarrassed that I can't, because it's something that I should have looked at in this context. And so, thanks for the question.
I'm free to answer the next question. Anthony?
So, I'm a little bit puzzled. I mean, you said that you think that the existence of linear superposition is not quantum, but somehow, from the way you put it, in terms of what you can find out in subspace without needing to measure vectors spanning it, I mean, it sounds to me that you're in effect saying that the central point is linear superposition.
Well, yeah. Well, I'm not saying linear superposition is not involved, but Look, it's linear superposition and entanglement are both involved, but the way in which they're involved really is more clearly understood in terms of the subspace structure.
Because the subspace structure, I mean, isn't that essentially linear superposition?
Yeah, I mean, that's, you can say that. So, but I mean, when you say that the, I guess that, that I could answer your question by, you know, if I say I agree with you or I don't agree with you. So the sense in which I agree with you is that, yes, the subspace structure is essentially a linear superposition. The sense in which I would sort of make a negative comment, not to your specific question, but I wanted to try and get away from this idea that linear superposition is involved in the sense that Deutsch would like to see it, that you have many parallel computations occurring at the same time. So that's what I want to
say. You've gone away from parallel computations, but Deutsch would still come back and say, look, it's suggested that linear superpositions are somehow physical objects. Right? You can find out this object without having to find out the components. So Deutsch could very easily come back and say it still supports many worlds.
But how does it support many worlds? Why did, I mean, I guess the way
well, I mean, if a superposition is a physical object.
No, I think precisely the importance of this, right, coming as a layperson here, I didn't understand almost no detail of the talk, but I think I got the key point. The key point is that you can ask a question in quantum mechanics, like with the EPR state, you can ask the question of, is it in the EPR state? And therefore know something about correlation amongst the pairs without making the two measurements.
Sure, I mean, that's what you've really got. But what I'm saying, it would be very easy to say that, look, you know, superpositions are real objects. And then you're just a hair's breadth from saying, well, and this is supporting effort. I mean, I'm not claiming that you have to get to everything. But I see Deutsch as being, I mean, from the point of view of saying that Edward is involved in it, it's still, I don't think you demolish that position.
Well, I don't see that I'm committed to saying that superpositions are real objects. I'm not sure exactly what's involved in that, but I'm sort of feeling that there's sort of a slippery slope to something bony. That is to say that my own view would be, there are probably more questions, so.
Sure.
So
I think that question, that's another late person question here. And actually, the idea that, that's apparently what you say, that it's crucial that even quantum mechanics can measure some global property without knowing the details. And I liked that quite a lot throughout the talk, but then I thought, is this really, I think there must be something else, because you could have it classically as well. Let's say I have a million different marbles, and I want to know, you know, how much does each one weigh. So I put them all individually on the scale, and then I'll tally it up, and I find out how much they each one weigh. Like, so that's a tedious problem to do. But I could find out what they weigh in total without measuring individually. So the model is
and that's one. Theta.
And that's a theta. And I can do this classically. So I would never know what individually they weigh. And still I find out what they weigh together. So you can do that classically. So the idea is there, but there must be something else.
Well, the difference here is that, take the very first algorithm, the XOR Deutsch algorithm. There is no way, classically, there the problem was this. I mean, you're given a function from 0, 1 to 0, 1, and so there are four possible functions, and you have a box which is computing one of these functions. How can you find that? Can you find out in one run of the box of the algorithm, or one call to the oracle, whether it's constant or balanced? And classically, it's impossible. You would not be able to find the answer to that question, that global question, without finding the answers to, so to speak, But I mean, there are other cases where you might, but so the speed up is, yeah.
What distinguishes the ones where you really need quantum from those that you could do classically?
Well, what distinguishes them is that classically, I mean, you have a situation where classically you have to run through a whole bunch of steps in order to get the answer to the global question. And in those cases where at least sometimes, you can hook up a quantum algorithm which will be the equivalent of weighing all these models. I mean, classically, with this weighing, with the problem of finding out the weight of a whole bunch of models, there is apparently a way of doing it without finding out the individual weights. Classically, there are other problems which don't have that feature, where you need to do the equivalent of measuring the weight of each model, and quantum mechanics allows you to get the answer without measuring the weight of each model. Because in all these cases, there is no way of getting the answer to the equation classically by doing something in one step, which is finding the value of this global property of this junction.
Okay, I guess you kind of...
So just a short comment.
Okay.
Yes, yeah, so when you actually implement random algorithm, you do it always...
Classically?
Yeah. You always do it deterministically because it's...
Right.
So what's really being said is that you found another deterministic algorithm outperforms the more normal deterministic algorithm. I mean, on a computer there's no... things like real randomness, you just have super randomness. So it seems like, one has to think about that, so there's just a different definition of missing out.
Yeah, but there's a great resource.
This is just common.
So that's your point, but I don't think that can quite be the right thing to say.
The fact is that it's too deterministic algorithms, and one's better than that. That's probably why they're in the same class as well.
Can I just interrupt and say, why don't we thank our speakers for very interesting talking. Discuss.